There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Welcome back, I'm Carl Mack, and this is Combat Chronicles, precisely episode 47 of Combat Chronicles. We'll be talking about in the main UFC 288. What about in the main? We're going to be talking about exclusively UFC 288, but in the main event, which is Aljamain Sterling versus Henry Cejudo. And you may be wondering what my thoughts were going into this fight. You may be wondering where the podcast has been for nearly a whole month. Well, it's been over on the Patreon, www.patreon.com/combatchronicles. Content over there comes, I wouldn't say thick and fast, but semi-regularly, and the podcasts follow the format much as these ones do. So it's basically, you know, no intro, no ads, but the same sort of format, same amount of fights discussed, still boxing, MMA, kickboxing. If you like these episodes, be sure to check out the Patreon as well. But on that Patreon, well, I did my preview for Aljamain Sterling and Henry Cejudo. Essentially, I didn't know how it was going to go due to the unknowns, what Cejudo was going to look like, etc. And I think that sort of played out in the fight because it ended up being, and I would say usually it's a bad kickboxing match, but this was a weird, janky mixed martial arts bout, essentially, in terms of the striking, and it was mainly a striking bout. So let's get into it. Aljamain Sterling winning by split decision. Elephant in the room. I think Aljamain Sterling did deserve to win it. If you're looking at how them scorecards were actually tallied, though, and Henry Cejudo would have won the title and the bout if the fifth round had been scored his way unanimously, and it wasn't. I think that's obviously the massive problem here. The rest of the rounds, in here and there, maybe not, but they're all competitive and relatively sort of low output in terms of scoring stuff. So obviously going to get into that as we go through the analysis. But I think mainly the fight is a story of failings on Henry Cejudo's part to not be able to beat Aljamain Sterling when Aljamain Sterling's primary form of offence and primary style was essentially taken away of him by how good Henry Cejudo is at what he does. So let's get into it. Aljamain Sterling, I've said many times before on this podcast, he's janky, he's weird, he is effective, but striking's not really his thing. He's not particularly terrifying in terms of, you know, sort of the heat he can bring on his punches, on his shots. He's a good kicker. He is awkward in that regard. He is awkward all round, really. He's just janky. Got a bit of sort of a lower weight John Jones to him in a way. The way he attacks with sort of unorthodox techniques, oblique kicks, you know, spinning attacks when he sees the opportunity for him. Not really a functional jab despite his range. Not really a great boxer by any means. As I say, janky, weird, and usually due to the threat of being taken down, that's enough to get people to have second thoughts about attacking him. But in this fight, Henry Cejudo didn't really have that as an issue because obviously he's a fantastic wrestler in his own right. And one thing I will say in terms of Henry Cejudo coming back is that he appeared very, very sharp athletically. Kick catching was great. Takedown defence was, as you'd expect, great and very well equipped to deal with Aljamain Sterling's preferred method of attack, being back takes, back triangles, that sort of thing. So, you know, attacking legs, attacking posts, doing whatever he can to not give Aljo that attempt to get on his back, because he knows, look, Aljo, if you're going to try and finish me without getting your hooks in, it's going to be very easy for me to turn India and get out of this position. And basically, I'm just not going to allow you to get that back triangle. He's probably seen other fights of Aljo's where, you know, the back triangle was, yes, certainly not conducive to winning rounds. But essentially, look, do you know what? I'll give up any attempts for you to attack my neck or strike, because paramount to surviving or being in the rounds enough to win them is to not allow you to take my back. So you know, staved off the back take and therefore was basically willing to let Aljo do whatever in his pursuit of that. So Cejudo was very well drilled, very well prepared to avoid that. So how did he still lose? If Aljamain Sterling was not able to do what he wanted to do, how did he still beat Henry Cejudo? And not just in terms of scorecards, but why was it that Henry Cejudo was not able to do what he needed to do to win rounds consistently or win or have enough moments in rounds to win successfully? And I do think 1, 2, 3, and 4 were all, I don't think there were any clear-cut rounds in those first four rounds. I really do think, you know, there's moments where you think Aljo's kicking's got the better of it, or, and if we're talking about adjustments needing to be made, Aljamain Sterling's ability to adjust into, okay, I can take you down, but I can use the body lock pressure against the cage. I can then use that to leverage that to knees in the clinch. Really good work from Aljamain Sterling to do that. But I thought they were all pretty close, nip and tuck rounds. Do think Aljamain Sterling got the better of it, but why was that? Because essentially he doesn't really pose much of a threat. His defensive work is essentially move backwards or laterally, skirt around the perimeter and get you to follow him, get you to chase him. And that is essentially the crux of the problem. A lot of following from Cejudo, a lot of languishing at range, struggles with Aljamain's length. I wouldn't say it's reach, because as I say, in terms of functional kicking, not a lot of teeps, not a lot of straight attacks. It's just sort of middle kicks, low kicks and sort of flapping punches. Yes, certainly there's a degree of awkwardness that Cejudo didn't really get a read on early. But I do think that's also to do with not cage rust, so to speak, because I say athletically he appeared to be on point in terms of his timing and what have you. But certainly in terms of a couple of things, in terms of dealing with that reach, Cejudo did make adjustments to go, right, OK, I'll punch off of clinch breaks. So when we get into a tangle, I'll punch off then. If I can't get close enough to sort of consistently land through his additional length, then when we do get in those, I will punch out those clinch breaks. Nice work. Adjusted later on as well, intercepting knees in the later rounds as well, and tried to use those. But essentially, Cejudo did make that adjustment. But why didn't he get close to Sterling enough? And I think if we look at the fight, the crux of it is in that fifth round. Well, suddenly it's not, I'm following you around. Suddenly it's not, I'm fainting at mid-range, not certain of what you're doing, allowing you to kick me and then reset, spin off, and then reset the motion of me trying to close you down. Sterling was very easily able to get to where he wanted to be, which is well away from Cejudo, whenever he wanted to. So he's already got the added advantage of the reach and length, and then he hasn't got Cejudo on his ass as much as he needed to. In that fifth round, we see Cejudo's route to success upon closing him down, not allowing him to just put his hands out there, actually hand fighting, cutting him off with low kicks, working his way in the range with feints and throwaways to allow Aljo, to not allow Aljo a direct exit, to actually move him and herd him where he wanted to move him into in order to try and land that overhand right. Also as well, actually in that fifth round, using going upstairs, downstairs to use body shots to try and close off Aljamain Sterling's exit route. Perfect stuff. Needed to do more of that. And I think really the main issue was that Cejudo, it's not just a degree of awkwardness with Sterling, because he is an awkward operator. Usually that awkwardness is sort of accentuated by people being worried about being taken down. And actually in this fight that wasn't a major issue for Cejudo, and even if it was, he's such great get up ability and such a great defensive wrestler that it wasn't really a major concern for him. As I say, he had the back mount scouted out perfectly, but I think Cejudo just wasn't really able to weaponize his durability. A long time out, probably wanted to feel himself in the cage, get used to it. By that fifth round, there's that call for Mexican style, which I hate because such broad strokes, but I get it. Which essentially is, we need you to pressure more. And it was obviously apparent to them that he wasn't pressuring enough. And actually, in the one thing I said in the preview was, you know, Cejudo, I would say, sort of striking-wise, he's anti-stylist, really. We've seen him sort of get mesmerised by, say, DJ in their rematch and sort of match his output. And actually, what he needs to do is be a proficient pressure fighter. We see him barrel in the TJ. We see him absorb everything Marlon Moraes got and walk him down and weaponize his durability and just give him a pacing, essentially. So if you're not scared of Marlon Moraes, who was one of the most dynamic strikers, pound for pound at the time, really, and was giving Cejudo a right clattering, then why are you concerned about breaching into Aljamain Sterling's space? And I think it's just got to be due to time out of the cage, feeling himself, trying to find his comfort level in the fight. Seemed pretty confident early, you know, with kick catching and timing, and essentially, you know, not being able to be grappled by Sterling. Don't think that was an issue. Just that front foot pressure was not there until way too late in the fight. So that's part one of what Cejudo didn't do well. Second part, not really doing enough with good grappling positions. Got that front headlock more than once. There seems to be no submission threat there. Cejudo probably didn't feel it was there, but not enough striking. You know, at the end of the day, if you strike, then you'll give up one of those hand positions and Sterling will get up. If you're not going to do anything with it, you might as well, because in that scramble, as I say, on that break, you might be able to land something. There were times where Cejudo would sort of land pity-patty punches. You've got to do something to score. Just a couple more of them and you make those rounds that Sterling wins earlier closer, or you completely flip them and win that. There was sort of no attempt to use that front headlock to try and get to the back, really, and get to a more advantageous position where you could strike more. I think Cejudo really needs to utilise those positions better, or just use them to get out quickly, return to a striking position, as I say, retain that pressure. Because he got embroiled in a sort of Aljo-ish kind of fight here, in those fights where we don't see Aljo dominate via his grappling. You know, just sort of relatively low output, certainly low accuracy sort of striking bout. And really, Cejudo was in a better position than anyone because he's just got less of an issue with the grappling, and we know how durable he is. So I think he'll watch that fifth round back and think, shit, if I'd done that in the fourth round, then by the time the fifth round come around, Aljo might have been blind a bit harder and I might have got to him. And I think basically it's all a case of confidence, and I think it's just a case of just getting a little bit more sharp with the timing, because this was a really nip and tuck fight. I think Aljamain Sterling deserved the win. I think it just, his kicks generally were the more, the shots that just punctuated the rounds more. There was just more of them. Could I say anything other than more? They were a frequent standout in the 5 minute stanzas. So I think, you know, essentially, I think that's why Aljo just about got the win. But in terms of, you know, looking out at the round scoring and seeing what Henry Cejudo looked like after 3 years out against a guy who we know is the best bantamweight in the world and has put on far more proficient displays against, not better than Henry Cejudo, but I would say more dynamic offensive fighters than Cejudo, such as Piotr Jan, and knowing as well what Jan did in those championship rounds in the second fight, even after having significantly worse spells in the rounds than Henry Cejudo. I think Cejudo will be kicking himself. I think Cejudo will feel that this was definitely a winnable fight. And I think that it's not like the Volkanovski-Makachev fight where you go, do you know what, Makachev deserved to win, but Volk showed a lot about himself in that fight. How Makachev won was not how we thought he would win. It's not really like that, because I think Makachev could have deservedly won that fight, whereas Volk really probably didn't. It was probably a clear 3-2. Whereas in this fight, Henry Cejudo probably could have done, because these rounds were sort of so iffy and not a huge amount happening. Sort of Cejudo would half land with punches and Aljo's sort of kicking him, but they are caught and then Cejudo's dumping him on his ass, you know. The takedowns don't go anywhere. I would hate to think that they contributed to the judges' assessments of the rounds in any way, shape or form. So, I don't know, man. I feel like Volkanovski done so much for himself in that Makachev fight, to continue with that comparison, just to show what skills he had, and Makachev had to show other skills to beat him. But in this one, I feel like Cejudo just could have done more. I don't think Volkanovski could have really done more in that fight. He'd done brilliantly. I think Cejudo was sort of let down by his lack of activity, lack of front foot pressure, and just a lack of decisiveness and how to approach, how to pressure Aljamain Sterling. Could it be that he just figured him out as the fight went on? Could it just be that he did just get too many awkward reads early? Because I would say, oh, well, he struggled with the jab, the reach. He struggled with the kicks. He struggled with the unorthodoxy. But really, most of Aljamain Sterling's attacks, Cejudo picked up on pretty quickly, was able to counteract them pretty quickly. And the best bulk of what Sterling's skill set brings to the bout, Cejudo cancelled it out relatively easily. So it does seem to be failings on Cejudo's part. But as I say, that's not taking anything away from Aljamain Sterling. Very much the case of, you know, his adjustment to go, do you know what? I can still win a fight like this. You are taking away what's best about my skill set, but I can still win a fight like this. I can adjust. I have got an extra dimension to my game. I thought that was brilliant. And I think it's worth saying that. I think it's fantastic that Aljamain Sterling is the bantamweight champion. The deepest division in MMA, and it's essentially a bit of an old-fashioned stylist, big of an old-fashioned specialist, really, that's winning. I'm sure people will say, oh, come on, man, he's a mixed martial artist. But I'm just saying, in terms of, think about a mixed martial artist as somebody who's sort of, you know, good in all components of the game. And I don't really think Aljamain Sterling is a very good striker. I think janky and somewhat effective and awkward is great. I'm into awkward stylists, always have been. But I think if you look at it, he is very much a specialist. I wouldn't say his striking's even on the level of someone like Khabib or Islam Makhachev, and they're grappling specialists too. So I hope you can see where I'm coming from. My assessment is not meant to dig at Aljamain Sterling, it's actually meant as a positive. But the other comparison I've seen this week is really Cejudo versus Aljo versus GSP versus Bisping. And I think people sort of said, well, look, when GSP came back, he won the belt. And it's like, well, I think Bisping was better overall at MMA than Aljamain Sterling is in terms of what his style is. Obviously, he was really a bit of a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. Aljo is a master of one and, you know, somewhat of a jack-of-other-trades, but Aljo's in his prime, Bisping was not. GSP chose Bisping because he thought he could win the belt. Cejudo come back and fought the absolute number one. In terms of lineage, Bisping was number one, but there's very much some better middleweights around at the time. I don't think that's the case at bantamweight. I think Aljamain Sterling has proven himself the best bantamweight in the world, in spite of the sort of inadequacies I see with his style. Hey, he knows who he is and he's fucking good at it, and he's beating a wide range of stylists now, as his record shows. So you don't get to be the number one in UFC at 135 without actually being elite. And he is absolutely elite. I've seen people disputing that this week. Don't get it at all. Having a nip and tuck bout, essentially, with a top 5 pound for pounder is more impressive than what GSP did against Bisping. However, and that's not a dig Bisping, brilliant career and justified champion at the time. However, the reason this is an interesting one is not about the case-for-case comparison about what win was better, but a case-for-case comparison of what GSP did to Bisping, which was, I'm having some issues here, he's marking me up, there are certain issues I'm having at range, I have to throw the kitchen sink at him, I have to leverage my superior gifts in time and accuracy to fucking hurt this guy. And Cejudo figured that out too late. And I think that's the difference in the comparing the two fights in terms of fighters who took a couple of years out, came straight back into a title fight, one of which won, one of which didn't. I think it's about the approach. And I think, you know, Cejudo will be kicking himself. And I think he'll be wishing that he'd stepped on the gas a little bit earlier. It's not just a case of, oh, yes, walk forward and throw more punches, mate. It's the stuff he was doing in that fifth round, that front foot pressure, giving Aljamain Sterling more to think about, changing levels, etc. This is stuff which is quantifiable in terms of the tape, and I don't think there should be any sort of debate whatsoever as to what Cejudo needed to do to win this fight. It's, again, not taking anything away from Aljamain Sterling. The fact he was able to win a close fight against someone as good as Henry Cejudo is just another notch on his bedpost, really. He really is fucking excellent. Let's take a little commercial break now, and again, you don't get those over on the Patreon, but you have to put up with it now before we look at some of the highlights from the rest of the card.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Actually, let's not go to the rest of the card. Let's first address the what does Henry Cejudo do next rumours. Because the idea maybe he was going to retire, will he get an instant rematch? And it looks like he wants to fight later on the year, UFC in Boston, and he wants to fight Mirab Dvalishvili. So for me, that's a perfect fight. Mirab, I think it's said on this podcast before, essentially is running a sort of old school enforcer role where you got to beat him to get a title shot because he's not going to fight his good mate Aljo. Used to be used by promoters back in the day to sort of stop someone they didn't want to get a fight who might dethrone their guy, getting to fight someone of a similar ilk or someone trickier that could beat him before he got to the title fight. In this instance, Mirav's basically like sort of, your name's not down, mate, you're not coming in sort of role to stop them getting to his mate in the VIP lounge, like the bouncer. So I think it's a great fight, the unstoppable wrestler versus the unwrestlable. And, you know, Mirav's just constant engine versus Cejudo's apparent want to sort of find his spots and find his time. And I think it's a great fight. Mirav's a tank at 135. I think Cejudo could probably still make 125 if he really wanted to, although that might have been because he's fighting one of the largest 135s I've ever seen, and Aljamain Sterling, who's sort of as broad as he is long. And yeah, I think Mirav versus Henry Cejudo is an absolutely perfect fight, because if Henry wins, built-in narrative for a rematch. There's obviously a logjam at 135. Aljo can fight someone in the meantime. And if Mirav wins, then Aljo will almost certainly move up, and Mirav Dvalishvili will fight for the vacant title. It appears, if we're talking about what's Aljo doing next, as we saw when Mirav stole his jacket, Sean O, Michael Jackson Malley is going to be fighting Aljamain Sterling. I'm absolutely fine with that. You know, grappling wise, it should be a wash, but in terms of length, striking, jankiness, precision, sorry, let's just talk, start again. Length and jankiness and sort of weird dimensions, O'Malley's got Aljamain Sterling beat in terms of his striking, his precision, his overall arsenal, how dangerous he is and how volatile it is to fight the guy. I think O'Malley's got Aljamain Sterling beat. So it's very much sort of specialist versus specialist, really. Where if Aljo can't sort of get to where he needs to, he could be in serious fucking trouble, because he ain't going to sort of out-jank O'Malley, and where it sort of Aljamain could just speed run him like he did Corey Sandhagen. So anyone saying they're not interested, I think you're wrong. And I think O'Malley sort of is as deserving sort of as anyone at 135 based on his recent fight with Piotr Jan. And yeah, I mean, has he jumped the queue? Yes, he has, but he's somewhat marketable. And it's only good for Aljamain's legacy if he gets more eyes on his fights, because he's not the most exciting guy to watch sometimes. To the layman, I think speedrunning Corey Sandhagen was really fucking exciting, but I think most people would rather see sort of knockdown, drag out wars, of which the kind he is rarely in. So I think Aljamain Sterling versus Sean O'Malley get a lot of eyes on it. Sean O'Malley's rated by the casual. If Aljo can beat him, it's only going to have the casuals realise how good he is, which can therefore leverage in the, you know, marketability, profitability, etc., etc. And as I say, if he could beat O'Malley and Cejudo could beat Mirab, then fucking hell, the rematch is absolutely huge, isn't it? One last thing on the fight, by the way. Didn't think it was particularly great, Cejudo versus Sterling. It was fine. The grappling exchange is really interesting to watch, as you sort of, will they, won't they, how's this going to play out? But yeah, generally I found it quite a tepid affair. Now, on to the rest of the card. And speaking of tepid affairs, Belal Muhammad versus Gilbert Burns. The storylines coming after the fight are somewhat more interesting than the fight itself. Drafted in to replace the lost co-main event of Charles Oliveira versus Benil Dariush, which would have been just a fantastic second part of this podcast, wouldn't it? My God, sure to be loads to talk about in that, regardless of how it went down. Drafted in late, 5-round co-main event, essentially we'll talk about it, but I think most people would have assumed going in that it was a kind of like de facto welterweight eliminator. I think based on the aftermath, it might not be, and it's really unfair because these guys took the fight late notice. Gilbert Burns appeared to have an arm injury. Belal Muhammad definitely had an ankle injury. Belal, the fight's not that interesting to talk about. Belal pissed it, essentially. Just sort of spamming middle and eye kicks at Gilbert Burns. It's damaged arm. Not really much to talk about. Not much. No grappling exchanges. Burns sort of tried to adjust and shift into southpaw stance to land a short right hook, and over and over again it didn't really work either. Couldn't really get much going mid-range. His boxing, which has got so much stronger in recent years and definitely in recent fights, was basically a non-entity, and where he usually gets his bread and butter in terms of grinding top grappling and just pulverising you into meat, didn't really happen either. So Belal Muhammad, worthy winner, fairly one-sided stuff for the main part. And I think it's pretty obvious that both men were impaired Gilt Burns probably more so, but turns out afterwards that Bilal Muhammad was really badly impaired on the ankle as well. So I'm not going to say, oh, well, Burns was injured, so it doesn't matter. No, Bilal Muhammad won, won fair and square. Just wonder whether we could have done something else. We didn't really need to see that so quickly. It seems to me that UFC just sort of went, oh, fuck it. We need a co-main event, chuck them in. I mean, they're giving us worse. Was there any need to sort of put these guys' health at risk? Two of your top five fighters in a division that's relatively barren. However, you would think saving the card to some extent and winning clearly against a top five fighter would put Bilal Muhammad in line for a title shot. But I do wonder, now he's shown his hand in terms of being injured, whether the UFC will punish him for that. And sort of, you made us look bad. You made us look like horrible, slimy bosses. You don't get a title shot now, or you've got to fight Chimaev or fucking Shavkat Rakhmonov to get one. Just give fucking Bilal Muhammad a title shot now. It's pretty clear that he deserves one. Him and Leon Edwards have fought before, so you might as well. And either way, you get it done. So, yeah, fucking hell, man. I just feel bad for both these guys, especially because, you know, neither of them are all that young, certainly not Gilbert Burns. And, yeah, you know, two grindy fellas who have grinded their way to the top, essentially been thrown into the meat grinder in this fight, where it just didn't really feel that great to watch, and it felt like both men weren't really operating at top capacity. And unfortunately, afterwards, the main narrative is, oh, Bilal Muhammad's always fucking boring. Like, we didn't see him look way better against Sean Brady. So give him a bit of respect. Bilal's not my favourite fighter by any means, but this run he's on, really impressive, and fair play to him for winning. Pretty one-sided fashion, in my opinion, even though it wasn't all that interesting or dynamic to watch from a stylistic standpoint. It's all about weaponising durability. I don't think Jessica Andrade's going to do that much longer. She got fucking chinned. Movsar Evloev versus Diego Lopez is very interesting because we've been waiting for now for Evloev versus Bryce Mitchell for a while. I think he's fallen out of bed a couple of times. Fell out of bed at late notice this time. Just waiting for Evloev to actually get someone in the sort of top 10. You know, he's in there, but I think, like, you know, his skill set is not being met by his competition at this stage. And Bryce Mitchell would have been a good one for that. Bryce Mitchell got some skill nowadays as a sort of straight punching, sort of counter puncher, range kind of puncher, but well known for his grappling. It would have been interesting to see if Evloev, who's also known for his top grappling, take on someone like Bryce Mitchell. Well, got chucked Diego Lopez at late notice, who trains with Alex Grasso, and you know, just some random Mexican bollocks fit. Looked at his record, he's lost in every conceivable way you can think of. He's been knocked out, tapped, and lost by decision as well. Hadn't seen any of his prior fights. Apparently he'd been on Contender Series for ACB or something like that at some point as well, but I just hadn't seen any of his previous fights. So yeah, I wasn't really too excited for the fight, and just thought, well, you know, if Evloev, late notice, at least he's fighting, squash match, whatever. Totally opposite of that. Really fucking fun. Really fucking scrambly. Diego Lopez is really fucking fun. Absolute brawler, throwing heat on the feet. And on the floor, great hips. Always fucking attacking submissions. I felt like I was watching a fight from 2013 for some reason. I felt like something from one of those Fox cards. Just absolute carnage. Maybe it's because he looks a bit like Eric Silva and fights a bit like a smaller Eric Silva as well. But yeah, absolute fucking bedlam from start to finish. Even at the death, when he'd had his fucking head punched in, Lopez is still trying to tap Evloev, who's a really safe and patient top grappler, got caught in loads. Triangles, arm bars, got him caught with the famous Sakuraba Kimura trick. You know, wherever he was not safe. There are points where you're like, oh, he's nowhere near something there, and then next thing you know, he's being turned over, he's in a fucking armbar, or he's in a knee bar, having one of his limbs wrenched from his body. So, really brutal. Difference was that Lopez was essentially a brawler on the feet, and an opportunist on the ground, whereas Evloev actually had a process. Especially from the second round onwards, he'd double jab his way in, he'd throw away to set up the right hand, he'd double up on the right hand, switch a southpaw to get closer with the right hand, and then pop one off there. And on the ground, just methodical, trying to control the wrist, working his way in with ground and pound, really managed to stack Lopez at points and rain down some really heavy blows on him. The first round I thought was Lopez's. Also, they have some random fucking people. As if the commentary isn't bad enough at what's the best way to put this? The commentary isn't bad enough at putting out a false narrative about how fights are meant to be scored and what we're watching on fights. They have some random fucking people popping up, you know, random Twitter people popping up because they've paid for a blue tick. It used to be because they had a blue tick. But it's always the same people, most of which, you know, you wouldn't want to talk to. If you listen to this podcast, you don't want to talk to those people. Do you know what I mean? Some guy came up this time and said, yeah, Lopez had some big moments in round one, but Avloyev had so much control time. Three things. A, control time is not really part of the scoring, not when there's so much scoring work going on in that round, which there was. People getting their fucking heads punched in and nearly getting their arms ripped off. That's what you score on before the control time. Secondly, Avloyev done scoring work in that round. Why not mention that? Why not mention the ground and pound? Why not mention the striking upstairs? Why not mention that? And thirdly, how much control time is it if you're constantly on the fucking danger of being swept or put in submissions? Control time, mate. Are you that fucking stupid? I'd never heard of the cunt before, to be honest with you, so I can't remember his name now. But you do see a lot of people in there that you do recognise from Twitter. Some obviously better than others. Shout out to my man Dan Tom. He's been on there a few times before. I didn't see him on this card, but, you know, one of the smartest minds going. But mainly it's people where you go, I don't fucking want to talk to these people about fighting. They ain't got a fucking Scooby. So you've got them coming out of equally fucking stupid opinions. How are fans supposed to get more well-educated if you've got the commentary telling them a load of shit and then you're essentially signing off on these social media opinions that are also talking absolute shit? What isn't absolute shit was the fight, which was fantastic. Will almost certainly be on the shortlist for Fight of the Year at the end of the year. And Avloyev, in a way, did answer some questions that we would hope that Bryce Mitchell would have raised. You know, he's fucking really tough. He can get out of bad grappling situations. He does have a process on the feet to circumnavigate a dangerous striker. I mean, Lopez is a fucking brawler. He's the opposite of what Mitchell was worked his way into as a striker, which is sort of patient, punch-picking, sort of counter-puncher. He's not great at it, but I think he does pretty well, as evidenced in the Edson Barboza fight. Lopez is just fucking gunslinging, standing up and on the ground. Great to watch. And Avloyev worked his way through it, went through the process, was patient, was calm, and, you know, didn't lose his temper, didn't lose his focus. And because of that, he survived even that knee bar attempt at the end. So I thought he was a 29-28 winner. You could sort of make a case for the third round, in my opinion. When I before went off on this tangent, I was saying Lopez won round one, in my opinion. Avloyev won round two. And I think you could make a case for Lopez to win round three, because even though there was some really vicious striking going on, which is sort of the main sort of criteria, he was really doing damage and getting close with his submission attempt. So I think there, you know, it's the Kimura trap and the knee bar at the end. Dependent on where you see them in terms of the criteria, yes, the striking is the main thing, but they were clearly really damaging submission attempts and they were relatively close. You could somehow see that round through, in my opinion. I don't. I still go with Avloyev's striking on the feet and on the ground and pound. I thought he'd done a lot of that, and there's only really two moments for Lopez. But colour me interested in Lopez. I do want to see him again. Throw him in fun fights. Same for Mexico cards, whatever. You know, he's clearly going to be in some fun scraps. He's not going to be a world beater. Haven't seen any of his other fights. This is one of the rare times where I'll go, yeah, I looked at his topology and I watched this fight and that's basically all I need to know. He's only 28, so he could still get better. But based on what I can see of how his career has played out up to this point and based on this fight, I know one thing. Regardless of how he gets on in his career, he's going to be fun. So let's keep him. Let's have him stick around. Let's get him in some fun fights, of which at 145 there'll be plenty. And yeah, just fucking let the violence commence. That was a really fucking fun performance and a really bloody good fight. If you haven't checked that one out, make sure you do. Only thing I'm going to say, Cron Gracie is cut him. No time for it. No time to talk about a fight. And Jourdain deserves better. There's a fun fighter who doesn't deserve to be fighting a butt scooter. So yeah, no interest in talking about that whatsoever. Just taking the Gracies back 10 years or, you know, were they ever really that good in modern MMA? No, but I would have expected after so much time off for Cron Gracie to actually add something to his game is fucking just terrible. So no thank you. But if we go back to that great fight, the Lopez Avloyev fight, the one that I thought was going to be great was Drew Dober versus Matt Frivola, and it was to an extent. Didn't quite go how I was expecting it to, and let's see why. Matt Frivola, of course, fighting out the Sarah Longo camp, and they had Trudeau, but well scout, in my opinion. Frivola makes sure that all his attacks were on his own right side to ensure that Drew Dober was always moving over to his own right. Dober loves to lance you with a jab and then pop you with the backhand off of that. So Frivola always getting Drew Dober to move across, meant he couldn't establish his jab. When they were still, or when Frivola was moving to his own left and Dober was able to track him moving to his right, that's when Dober was clearly having the more success. When they were stood still, but Frivola was able to attack him on Dober's left-hand side and get him to move across, essentially Frivola wasn't in the danger zone. But what he did have to do was show really good timing and poison those exchanges, because, you know, you don't really want to get into extended exchanges with Drew Dober. So what Frivola did was just mix up his approach. It would be high kicks. It would be that wide right hand. If you throw the straight with Drew Dober, he's going to be able to get there as you are. Obviously, usually if you go wide and the person goes straight, they're going to land on you. But I think, from what I can see, because he landed that right hand twice, Frivola, he was going so wide. I think it was going outside of Drew Dober's eye line because he was so focused on straight attacks. And it looks like it just went round and he just didn't see it coming. First time, it was just a good shot, well set up. Second time, as Dober was looking to exchange, coming forward, bopped him coming in, wiped him out, finished with ground and pound. What's great about Drew Dober is, and I don't know if the wars will catch up with him, he's been trading on his chin for a long time. He's one of the best action fighters in the sport. This might be the start of his downfall, but dropped by a big hitter, pulverised on the ground, face full of claret, still gets up, wants to carry on, dizzy, not with it. But Dober is just an absolute warlord, basically. And Frivola took him out. So I think Matt Frivola basically gave himself the best chance of winning, not getting in prolonged exchanges with Drew Dober, and not allowing Dober to jab his way in constantly by constantly forcing Dober over to his own right. I just think that he wasn't able to establish a jab enough. And really, it's the craft of Drew Dober. It really is. You know, you can get an exchange with him, but you'll see, especially like, you know, you see the Bobby Green fight or whatever, it's his craft. He will catch you in exchanges. He will set you up with feints, throwaways, rhythm changes, etc. And Frivola, by being janky and awkward, constantly causing Drew Dober to reset, really. That's the easiest way to put it. Not allowing him to build a rhythm by varying his attacks in terms of what he was throwing at him. But as I say, focusing on Drew Dober's left side, causing him, forcing him to move over to his right-hand side. Don't think Dober was really able to get it going as much as he would have liked to. So usually with a southpaw, you think, I'll keep my foot on the outside. But essentially, by not following him, Frivola was keeping himself out of the danger zone. Whenever he did move to his own left and Dober was able to track him, you saw that he looked sort of out of sorts, quite janky, unorganised. But as I say, if you can hit Dober with big shots, keep him moving across, I think you can keep yourself out of the danger zone. And poise-wise, I thought Matt Frivola did a really good job of getting big shots off and limiting the amount of times he was stood in front of Drew Dober. But yeah, I think to think that was like a Hail Mary or a one-off or a fluke is absolutely incorrect. He was landing big shots, whether it was the right high kick, the right Superman punch, the right hook. All them shots were landing for Frivola throughout that round. So clearly they had him marked up. They knew exactly what they were going to hit him with, and they gave himself the best chance of doing it. And yeah, obviously, you know, right-hand shot is the best shot typically against a southpaw if you can get your foot on the outside. But yeah, Frivola pulled it off, banged Dober out, and it was fun in those couple of minutes. I thought we were going to get more of an extended war, but generally I think that it was still fun enough. And even though I'm disappointed that Drew Dober lost, I think I would have been relatively disappointed whoever lost this fight. They're both really fun fighters. But those Sarah Longo boys were like, fuck it, man. He's hittable. You can bang with a right hand. You can get off good shots on him. And, you know, they rolled the dice. They went the war and they got it done. You know, sometimes you put two bangers up against each other, two warmongers against each other, and this will happen. And I think it's just, obviously, for most people, it's surprising because Drew Dober's been on such a run. He'd basically fight anyone. He was like, yeah, Matt Frivola, that sounds like a fun fight. Don't care that he's not above me in the rankings. I'll basically fight anyone. And his chin is essentially adamantium. Hope it is still after this fight. But he definitely took a pasting in this one. But hopefully, you know, his action fighter credentials are secured. And he still showed that in this fight. Boy, he didn't just go out like a light. He kept fucking trying. He kept scrambling. Took a beating. Face is smashed up. I'm sure once he's healed up, he'll still be a pretty handsome chap. But yeah, Matt Frivola, man, he's awkward, he's dangerous. I don't think he's ever going to be a world beater, but, you know, basically, you know, that sort of next tier of lightweight, you've got all these sort of awkward, dangerous fellas about, fucking chuck him in there. He's in the mix and just picked up, you know, really the best win of his career. And fuck me, that's a couple of dangerous bangers he's been up against in a row now. He fought that Otman Azatar, the guy who's supposed to fight Paddy Pimblett. He looked like a bit of a puncher. And yeah, fucking hell, he got fucking blammed as well. That's two first round knockouts in a row. Well, three in a row, but two against really, you know, relatively dangerous guys. Dober, even more so. I don't think I've fucking watched the... I don't think I've even remember Frivola's fight with Jalen Turner. Let me know in the comments if you thought that he actually deserved to win or not, because I don't remember seeing it. Obviously, Turner's come on leaps and bounds since then anyway, but I really don't remember that fight. I don't remember how it looked. Can't recall it whatsoever. But yeah, fucking hell, man. I just think that Frivola really did target and hone in on those attacks. And, you know, sometimes in a shootout, that's all that matters. You know, he knew what he was doing in there. And, you know, you see him sort of shuffle around for Frivola. He looks like he's from, you know, 2008. But he's fucking strong. It's really hard. And Drew Dober, he loves these sort of fights. You don't get to come out of all of them unscathed, I'm afraid. And just a really fucking good one. And, yeah, didn't live up to the potential that I thought it was going to. It was a war. But you tell me, you know, hate to quote Russell Crowe, but were you not entertained? It was really fucking mind-blowing to see Drew Dober, one of the hardest blokes in MMA, get chinned in the first round. So, yeah, great fight. One last fight I'll talk about from the undercard for the early prelims. Phil Hawes off to Bellator Hugo, although for some reason you'll probably get another opportunity. But he fought Ikram Eliskarov, who most people will know being blammed out by Khamzat Chimaev, pre-UFC. Good fighter. Apparently got a lot of credentials as a top line sambist. Liked him so far in MMA. I think he won a contender fight to get on. He was all over the shop in this fight, slipping all over the place, and still banged Phil Hawes. He sort of fell over, stood up, and then just banged him out. So all the talk about some sort of Khalil Roundtree-esque renaissance for Phil Hawes, sort of targeting with the rear side body kicks and just trying to sort of walk Eliskarov down, was all for naught. And he got collar tied, elbowed, kneed, and then got laid out by a bloke who just fell over. So, yeah, see you later. No interest in him going forward, sorry to say. Eliskarov needs to tidy it up a bit, but still, he's got some credentials. And dummy time's got to say it, but 185 so top heavy that I'd be happy to see anyone who can bring some interest to the division. So, yeah, let's give him another go and... put it down to, what, first fight UFC jitters and whatnot, or just the fact that Hawes was sort of out-athlete him in early. Eliskarov's clearly got something, so, yeah, let's see him. Let's see him again. Let's give him someone else. You know, 185's so sort of barren, you can give him anyone sort of top 15, I wouldn't really mind. Sort of outside of top sort of five guys. So, yeah, interesting stuff. That'll be it for this episode. If you want to hear my thoughts on Canelo versus John Ryder, Rising, mainly Burkow versus Ampo, and Demetrius Johnson rubber match with Adriano Moraes, and thoughts on the now official Takaru signing and Chatri Sitjon Dong talking absolute shit, be sure to head over to the Patreon, www.patreon.com/combatchronicles. That episode will be out tomorrow. Until the next free one on this feed, or until our next see you over on that aforementioned Patreon feed, oft-mentioned Patreon feed. Hope you enjoyed this one. Peace out, and thanks as always for listening.